Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. This is Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm here with Gus Cantavero.
Hello.
During the election campaign, there was a lot of talk about the free market economy, especially from Tea Party Republicans. Well, what exactly is the free market economy? Is it part of our current economic problem, or is it part of the solution? We're going to discuss these important questions in a moment with our special guest, economist Max Wolf. And we'd like you to put your two cents in. We're going to give out the phone number shortly. But first, Gus has some comments on yesterday's election. Go ahead, Gus.
Thanks, Ken. Yesterday's election results may have been exciting for some or upsetting for others, depending on your personal feelings. You might also be completely disenchanted with the entire process, feeling that both parties are merely two sides of the same coin. For the past 4 years, America sent a message to the Republican Party showing their displeasure by electing Democrats in waves. Today, fed up with the disingenuous talk of the left, America has turned back to the right. In 2 to 4 years, the process will begin anew and swing back in the other direction, infinitely repeating itself till the end of time. Unless there is another way. Let's start by giving this problem some context, if you will. The national news media has focused our attention on the national races for several key reasons. They're easier to cover than the local elections. They make compelling, dramatic stories and generate ratings. The national coverage would have you believe that these races are more important by never mentioning your local elections, causing most people to never think about them, and in turn have far lower participation. In addition, the corporate mega money goes to these congressional elections, governor's races, and obviously the presidency. However, according to our laws, are these national elections as important as they seem? Put simply, if you want to affect your country, you must start at the local level. Electing mayors, state representatives, and senators that respect the Constitution, you can form a state with a solid economy that can positively affect neighboring states. Looking to the federal government to solve your problems locally is why nobody feels that their voice is heard. The federal government may make a lot of big promises that make individuals feel hopeful, but no government of a nation this large can fix local problems. Healthcare, unemployment, the environment, and energy costs. These are all problems that can and should be fixed at the state level. Lastly, whether you want to have a third party or work to reform the existing two parties, that is up to you to help bring the debate to the mainstream. As it currently stands, a third party will never be able to afford the same type of advertising that the big two provide, which is why so many mainstream Republicans are so angry over Rand Paul and others who use their own system against itself. Whether you like him or not, he's an example of successful reform within the two parties. It is possible.
Thanks very much, Gus. And now we're going to discuss this free market economy question and how it relates to the recession. And we're very happy to have with us economist Max Wolf. Max teaches economics in the New School University Graduate Program in International Affairs, and his articles regularly appear in Asia Times and thehuffingtonpost.com. Max, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Max, as an economist, how would you define for our audience what a free market economy is?
Okay, well, the concept, as it's usually thrown around, is actually a utopian vision from the later period of the 18th century. So what people are mostly talking about is a fairly abstract fantasy from around the same period that the United States was emerging from its colonial position vis-a-vis England and into its independence. Actually, the most famous single text associated with this work or this sort of worldview comes from Adam Smith. It's called An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, and it was published in a year that's of some interest to Americans often, which is 1776. And what we often get, and I'm being diplomatic here, is marginally informed appeals to a 200-year-old text. But what the free market generally means is a relatively larger role for individuals to be motivated by their own self-interest, firms to be motivated by profit maximization, with a government basically mostly set up to guarantee private property and to guarantee competitive markets, because all the various utopian visions of the free market system require individuals who are free to choose and small competitive companies which don't become too large and too powerful so that they can't affect the market or the price in the market. This allows prices and profits to more or less organize human behavior. Self-interested firms seeking to maximize profit, self-interested people seeking to maximize their own pleasure, sometimes called the pleasure calculus, which is what it was called initially, work out through a competitive free market system and will be moved as if by an invisible hand, in the famous words of Adam Smith, to create, quite by accident, through their own self-interest, the greatest good for the greatest number of people. That's a sort of simple nutshell.
Well, thanks very much for that explanation. How does the current American economy measure up against that ideal free market economy? Do we have anything like it? Is it a mixture of things?
Well, nothing measures up very well to a 200-year-old utopian ideal, and likewise, the American economy does not. The central government of the United States will spend approximately $3.5 trillion, or $3.5 thousand billion dollars this year. The federal government makes an awful lot of the rules, and we have a marketplace in this country where almost every important segment of our economy is dominated by somewhere between three and five firms. So we have an incredibly active federal government, as well as relatively active state and local governments in many areas, and we also have a situation with large monopoly firms that can affect price. So we don't have the sort of small competitive firms with undifferentiated products and no market power, which the free market system requires, nor do we have a hands-off central government. We have things like the central government, which has the sole right to do something like, hey, I don't know, produce money, which is the way we measure all the prices in the first place, and on down the line. So the United States is a relatively more free market economy in some ways than many other world economies in the real world right now, but we're a far, far cry from that particular 18th century utopian vision, which motivates a lot of discussion and appeal in our political system, and really has since the founding of this country in 1783.
Well, as we look at the current economic situation, the very bad slump that we seem to be mired in, do you see that as a evidence of a malfunction of free market mechanism, or on the other hand, do you see it as perhaps the result of too much government tampering with the free market mechanism?
I think I would say it's sort of a whopping dose of neither and both, and I realize that's a fairly conflicted and strange thing to say. So let me make myself as clear as I can be, and to the extent it's not clear, it's probably more my thoughts at that point than my articulation. But I think that we don't have a problem as big, as structural, and enduring as the economic problems that are presently battering the American polity and economy without significant misadventures and failures in both your free market system, to the extent that that exists as anything other than a rhetorical device, nor with your government. And I do think that Americans have become used to a very unproductive, heavily ideological debate in which people go to their respective camp corner and scream at each other about more government, less government, big government, small government. And lost in this shuffle is, what does the government do? What does the government do well and badly? What does it do efficiently and inefficiently? What does the private sector do well? What does the private sector do badly? What does the private sector do efficiently and inefficiently? And so we get these kind of often highly corrupt and paid for by special interest gobbledygook ideological claims that masquerade themselves as real economic arguments. When I can tell you, as someone who spent the last 10 years teaching mostly free market-based economics, most of what our senators and representatives are saying often, and the pundits, would get you an F in an introductory econ class. Wow. In almost any university that's accredited in this country.
That's unfortunate to hear. Hi, Max. This is Gus. You're obviously you're saying quite a mouthful there, and I'm only a novice with economics, so please bear with me. You said quite clearly that there are two forces at work. We have pundits that say, we need a non-government intervention policy for a monetary policy. Obviously we need a Federal Reserve that doesn't inflate with no regard to our currency. And then we have the opposite side that puts it very bluntly and plainly and says, no, the government has to regulate every single aspect of your life. And it doesn't seem like there's any room in the middle for us to discuss, well, maybe it seems that the government has its place to regulate the market, but obviously there are some regulations that are bought and paid for by the big banks and insurance organizations out there that make it a favorable market for them to go ahead and take advantage of the weaknesses of a free market. We have some sort of monolithic banking industry that is unopposed and is able to create like a Ponzi scheme, the derivative scandal that created such a problem. So It doesn't seem like there's much room out there for credible arguments in the middle to say, you know, we need to have some regulation, but we also need to have free some kind of free competition so that banks have the ability to fail if they make some bad investments.
Sure, but people often get, I agree with you completely, but what's free in the free market is people's ability to buy and sell.
Uh-huh.
And if you took this to its logical extreme, that would also include buying and selling weapons, nuclear weapons, children, etc.
Of course.
So clearly we're going to have some restriction on the free market, which everyone favors. And clearly in the modern world, the notion of life without a large hand for the U.S. government, which, by the way, is the most transnational and potent government in the history of the world,
uh-huh.
and has been since 1945, which in no way slowed us down from telling everyone else the evils of government and why it's important to have a small government. But our tiny government spends $3.5 trillion a year, does half of the world's military spending, produces infrastructure all over the world, has several hundred foreign military bases,
uh-huh.
and right on down the line. So this
right.
notion, there's no one out there who's not either destined to be or already living in an inpatient care facility who doesn't see a huge place for the U.S. federal government.
Right.
What we're really getting is various sort of particular causes couched in this grand ideological debate, really of the 19th century, and sort of used that way as a sales pitch.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's a bit strange. I mean, for instance, the people who go to the various Tea Party rallies are required to travel on public roads, sometimes on public transit, to have used their public school education, because, you know, about 90% of us go to public school for some or all of our life,
uh-huh.
and use the public airwaves and use all these public inventions, like the Internet invented by the U.S. military, to communicate their ideas. So these anti-government movements themselves are not even imaginable without a huge potent role for the federal government. Likewise, the sort of government can solve all your problems crowd has a very utopian sort of, let's say, early 20th century notion of the government as a purely benevolent force that will come into the marketplace, come into the society, make interventions, sometimes martial and lethal interventions, and in so doing magically only create good and only create exactly whatever utopian outcome they most favor. And I think that cogent political debate requires us to move beyond that. And quite honestly, the seriousness of our present problems as a nation and as an economy mean that it's an existential threat for us to stay stuck in a highly ideological and limited and very unproductive debate.
Well, Max, we're going to invite our listeners to join in this conversation. We're at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756, and you're invited to join the conversation we're having with Max Wolf about the free economy and the current economic slump. Max, one area that the free market would seem to play a good role is, it goes to the root of the problem, the real estate collapse. The collapse of the bubble would may be the primary cause for our current difficulty. Should the government just let real estate find its own level, get wherever that may be, and then have things start over again, start to build again? Or should the government be trying to reflate real estate and try to bring things back?
I think that attempting, which the government has been doing at massive expense, to artificially push up the price of housing is not a good idea. Now, I think some management of the decline in the price of housing, any kind of rapid decline in any price that's central and important, is potentially dangerous, destabilizing, and impoverishing. And we should keep in mind when we have a discussion about residential real estate, particularly, you know, private homes and real estate, that the single largest asset most families own is their private home or apartment, condo, co-op. And so if you allow those prices to tank, what you're actually doing is putting the general public of the United States through one of the worst wealth-reducing episodes in history. So just letting it all go is probably not a good idea, nor is keeping the prices artificially high. And I think that a lot of people of conscience who want to see help for homeowners have a little bit of a rear-view mirror-only view of the world, in which they're looking back at all these people who are trying to stay in their houses, and many of whom could and should be helped to stay in their houses, but many of whom can't be helped to stay in their houses, and you aren't helping them by keeping them in their houses. That's a little bit of a rear-view mirror, because those people don't think about all the folks out there who can't afford a house at the artificially higher prices.
So eventually the prices will fall to a point where the low wages that people are now making will actually match house prices.
Or at least be a little bit closer, right?
Yeah.
And the way we've tried to substitute for that is by making the money you borrow for homes artificially cheap, so that we have a bizarre kind of confluence of effects right now, where borrowing money to buy a house, if you qualify, and that's a huge if you qualify for that mortgage, is unbelievably cheap, which would imply through market prices that we see housing, residential real estate, is an incredibly safe, low-risk investment, and that's in the immediate aftermath of the worst private real estate collapse in the history of the United States.
Right, it would be the exact opposite of that. It's not a great investment, even though the numbers would belie that fact and say that it is. So it's a contradiction.
Yeah, we clearly have a major contradiction.
So isn't that sort of like a dangerous game of chicken, though, because we have too much money floating around out there that isn't getting into the people's circulation? The people aren't making enough money to actually pay the prices that are being demanded as inflation goes up and people are deflating with their wages. So which is going to hit first?
Oh, that's the game. That's what makes quantitative easing, the QE2, the second round of quantitative easing announcement, the big story today from
right.
the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve is the chief architect of monetary policy in
right.
the United States. They're pushing the price level up. The economic weakness, the high unemployment, the lack of savings, and the debt overhang in American households is pushing the prices down and the economy down, and it's more or less a stalemate now. And this creates a lot of nervousness in corporate boardrooms, around kitchen tables and water coolers in companies, and also among economic strategists, because sooner or later somebody wins a tug of war. And our tug of war is between the deflating effects of economic weakness and the inflating effects of fiscal and particularly monetary stimulus.
What would
One
happen?
Side is going to lose grip of the rope here at some point, and if it does, then the whole system can dramatically flop to one of those two sides.
What would happen if the Tea Party program, which I think I understand to mean no more stimulus packages, I would assume no more quantitative easing, and just let it burn, sort of as the old the saying under I believe Andrew Mellon's time. What would be the result on the economy? Would we get this depression over with quicker and start over again with a lot of misery? Or are we just choosing a path which is going to extend the pain?
Sure. Well, it's a great question to which there is no answer. So I'll quote John Maynard Keynes, who has the best sort of one-liner on this among the famous economists, which is, the future is not unknown, it's unknowable. And that applies to everyone. And those folks who claim to know the future are certainly the most dangerously deluded folks that one could ever talk to. And my field, economics, is sadly full of them. But like weathermen, you learn somehow, whether wet or dry, not to trust us all the time. That said, I would say that the Tea Party movement displays the usual American schizophrenia about the role of government and the market. So you don't want government to do things like spend a lot of time and money providing vaccination for children, because that's definitely intrusive to have your children vaccinated. But it is okay for the central government to decide whether or not you should have a kid when you're the child, you know, the victim of rape or incest. It is okay for the federal government to execute you. It is okay for the federal government to tell you which god to pray to in school. Things that might normatively be seen by true libertarians to be somewhat distressing and a little bit beyond the realm of the minimum government.
Right. Yeah, those are all certainly libertarian principles, and if you take them all the way from start to finish, then you also would believe that you can't prop up a failing institution that is making bad practices.
You're listening
sure.
to In Context, and we're if you'd like to join the conversation with economist Max Wolf, call 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756 to join our conversation on the recession and free market system.
I think it might be worthy of just mentioning in this process two things, right? Which is that in the wake of the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case out of the Supreme Court this past year, what actually won in this election isn't so much Democrats or Republicans or Tea Party or anyone else. What really won was unrestrained money mixed with public rage. So what we really saw was a privatization of our electoral process mixed and sort of swirled around with a public that was enraged, that indiscriminately voted against Democrats who voted with the president,
right,
Democrats
right.
who voted against the president, Democrats who are conservative, Democrats who are very, very progressive, and all kinds of various folks who were successfully pilloried in a $3.7 billion avalanche of unrestricted and largely unreported money.
All right. We have a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Yes. Go ahead. You're on the air and In Context. You can speak to our guest, Max Wolf.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Max if he could comment on this price of housing, because whenever people talk about the prices of housing going down now, I never hear anybody say much about the fact that they went up so much for a period of time, so that isn't there some kind of reaching a realistic worth of the houses through this process?
Yeah, that's a good point, because we talk about the free market letting it burn, all that sort of, and it would be a depreciation of wealth that people had established after they bought their houses. But it was a fallacy to begin with. So do you have a statement on that, Max?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an excellent question. I mean, to begin to contemplate what a free market for housing would look like right now would be a very creative exercise in pure fantasy. So we have a situation where over the last 2 years, 95% of securitized home mortgages were bought by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, government agencies in the custodianship of the U.S. Treasury. The federal government has actively intervened to cheapen the price of housing in two ways for the last 75 years, and that is in making the mortgage interest payment deductible from taxes and in artificially keeping the price of mortgages down through many government agencies and policies, but principally in some years through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and a series of regulations. So we haven't seen anything like a free market for housing in this country in the lived experience of anyone under the age of 85 to 90, which means most of the general public, quite obviously. That said, when we did have a relatively more free market situation for housing in the country, we had a home ownership rate of between 25 and 30%, and 75%+ of Americans, you know, 70 to 75% of Americans were renters who couldn't possibly own a home, because without the subsidies that we've enacted, you wouldn't get mass home ownership in the United States. You wouldn't have, for instance, a middle class. The American middle class is a product of a unique situation at the end of the Second World War, where our major competitors were destroyed by the war, and a massive multi-hundred-trillion-dollar 60-year government intervention experiment in the United States. So the middle class, at least in any recognizable form in American history, is largely the creation of government interventions, as is anything that resembles anything in the housing industry that we've seen in this country for the last 75 years. That said, we've seen a systematic breakdown in that system of a really jaw-dropping variety, and we've actually seen it starting in 2001. It's just when the system was breaking down and prices were going up by 50% in 8 years, and the American public was busy taking out $5 trillion in home loans, which they did, between 2001 and 2007, that particular disastrous meltdown was seen as a euphoric, wonderful achievement of home ownership and the ownership society. And in the last 3 years, we've been learning that it was a tumor that was growing so fast, and that what we thought was the ownership society was always really the owership society.
Excuse me 1 second, Max. I think we have another call for you. Can you hold on 1 second? Caller?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Do you have a question for Max Wolf?
Yeah, talking about the low interest, the new low interest rates, and the problem is not many people can qualify for those new interest rates, but if there was a flat-out mortgage redo where everybody was about to lose their home, was automatically given this, say, 4.25%, extended another 10 years, reduced the payments, and 4% as opposed to 6-7% or 8%, is the payments would be almost cut in half of these homeowners who can't afford it right now. And it seems like that would be a simple, legal, I mean, the banks wouldn't be getting that large interest, true, and they would probably fight it. But have it almost mandatory, if you're about to lose your mortgage, you're allowed this new 4% interest rate, extend the mortgage for another 10 years, reduce the payments by half. You're saving probably 50% of the total amount of money that you're going to be paying by paying that cheap mortgage rate. And it seemed like it would not upset anything, except maybe screw the banks over a little bit, and they wouldn't get the... The reason.
Okay, call the committee. Like, give Max a chance to respond to that, please.
Sure. I mean, you have to remember a few things when you talk about mortgage modifications. One is that we do have a lot of people in homes who just simply can't afford those homes. And lowering their interest rate, while it would help some people and it's worth exploring in some cases, is only so valuable. You do have to remember that because of the interest rate deduction on income taxes, a significant portion of what you gain with the lower interest rate, when the interest rates are dropped on your house, you lose because your interest rate, your interest payment mortgage deduction vanishes with the smaller interest rate because you can't deduct principal, only interest. So that significantly tempers the effect, the benefit for folks. And I think the interest rates aren't really the problem. I mean, for some people they are, and trying to do modifications that help people with predatory interest rates makes a lot of sense if they can be helped. But if the average interest rate that Americans are paying right now is probably between 5.5% and 6.5%, dropping it to 4.5% might not keep everyone in their home. Now, it might keep some people in their homes, and that makes sense. But what it amounts to is a giant subsidy taken from the owners of that debt, which is principally the U.S. government at this time, because $5 trillion in U.S. housing debt is owned by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They've guaranteed it. So that comes out of the taxpayer money. So what it becomes is an elaborate, expensive, difficult to implement, giant subsidy for people who bought houses in the past and now can't afford them. I'm all for a public housing policy, but that one doesn't strike me as enormously rational, particularly fair, and it could very easily become a giant subsidy of older people who own homes by younger people who are working and presently don't, and a subsidy for people who work and pay income taxes but are renters. And we might keep in mind that on average, with some significant variation, people who are renting are less affluent than people who own homes.
Caller, thanks very much for raising that question. We're going to have to move on to another caller now, but thank you very much for coming on the show.
Whose show is this? I've just tuned in.
Oh, this is In Context to Ken McDermott and Gus Cantavero on WPKN 89.5 FM and streaming live at WPKN.org.
Hello. I'm a programmer over there.
Right. All right. But we have to move on. So thanks a lot for calling.
One of the other issues that this is pure fantasy, but
let's say if I can announce the phone number once more. It's 203-336-9756. We just have a couple minutes left, but if you'd like to get a question in to economist Max Wolf, give us a call at 203-336-9756.
Anyway, this is complete fantasy, but if you combine the money from the last bailout and TARP and all the different bailouts, and you combine the money that we spent waging empire war around the world, if the problem originally
was... Guess we have another caller. Can I interrupt you?
Can I just get through this?
Go ahead, caller. Thanks. You're on the air with Max Wolf, our guest economist.
Oh, hi. I had a question in terms of government intervention. It seems to me that one reason we've had all these bubbles is that, in our society, particularly in the last 40 years, wages are just getting driven farther and farther down. So the capitalists have to keep thinking of new ways to try to keep demand up, because the biggest contradiction is the individual capitalist wants to cut wage costs, but overall capitalism needs consumers to keep going. So after a while, it seems like they're sort of running out of gimmicks.
Well, let's be specific though. They're not capitalists. They're fascists.
Well, whatever.
Well, Max, what do you think of this?
Well, whatever particular label you might put on it, the single biggest problem that we've had in the macro economy over the last 35 to 40 years is stagnant to falling real wages and a reliance on global business. I don't think it's particularly an American business thing, but global business and the society as we've erected it and live in it is for people to continue to buy more than they can afford, and we've substituted longer hours, less vacation, more people in the house working, rising debt, falling savings, and government assistance to try to substitute for the fact that we keep living like we're getting the same raises in our wages that we did get from 1880 to 1970. We've kept living like that was happening the last 40 years. Only the last 40 years, those wages didn't go up.
Okay,
so
Max, let's say you're president, Max. What would you do to raise real wages in America?
Please hang up, man.
I think you need a massive investment in a situation where productivity levels rise faster than GDP and wages rise faster than productivity levels. And the way I think you do that is with regional development banks all over the country pushing and subsidizing people into new industries, not just but including green energy industries. And you'd have to make a massive investment in public education, a massive investment in infrastructure, and a massive investment in national health care.
Are you advocating for state banks such as like the Bank of North Dakota?
Sure. I mean, I don't know that that would be the place I would look to lead the country particularly, but it's not out of the question.
Oh, it's an example. Isn't it the only state in the country?
Banks, all of the models of the Federal Reserve.
I see. I was trying to get to a question before about all the money that we put into basically bailing out mega corporations in this country, and the money that we've spent on the war, many wars around the world, waging empire. That amount of money that could be saved by just calling the troops home, ending the war, couldn't that buy every single mortgage in the entire country and just leave everybody free and clear so that they could just go and reinvest in the economy instead of wasting it on overpriced houses?
It's possible. It would be the largest single wealth giveaway to people who've invested by buying home mortgage debt in the history of the world.
But, I mean, that money is just created out of thin air anyway by the Federal Reserve, so what difference does it make?
A small amount of it is. A large amount of it has been created historically by the economy, too. I mean, look, there is, I think, a reasonable point to be made about the amount of money the U.S. spends on military engagements around the world and a prudent reduction in that. Mm-hmm. I would mention, though, that much of the money could be reduced, but some of the money is part of how the United States has gotten to and stayed in a position of relative dominance, which does have positive economic effects sometimes, even though it often doesn't, and it often has terrible human effects around the world.
We have an industrial system, as you've alluded to the fact that we have a few corporations that dominate our economy. Can you conceive of a new economy that would be more decentralized, which would bring back the small entrepreneur as a sort of center of economic life?
Yeah, I think that would be a vital, interesting idea. That's sometimes referred to as the artisanal model. And what you have to do to make that work, and I do think that's a much more vital and humane way to go in many ways, is you have to have really serious enforcement of anti-competitive behavior. You have to make sure that firms cannot dominate their market. And you have to largely coddle and assist smaller firms to make sure that you're doing everything in the business environment to make sure that these smaller, more artisanal, locally based firms are viable. And that would involve, as against our present system, reducing the subsidies that we give largely to enormous corporations and enforcing competition laws and setting up systems and networks for local businesses to invest in making them more profitable and transnational corporations less profitable. And we've spent most of the last 30 years doing exactly the opposite of that.
Well, Max, we have another caller. I'd like to speak with you. Caller, you're on the air in context with our guest economist, Max Wolf. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah, yes, you're on the air,
ahead.
Caller.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering, I'm sorry I just recently joined the conversation. Just wondering what would happen if, like the Tea Party said, we abolished the Federal Reserve. And I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks, caller.
Thanks for the question.
Okay, so the Federal Reserve is technically independent. We have an independent central banking system. So the immediate oversight of the Federal Reserve is not directly something that either the President or Congress has the right to do. This is an area of great confusion because there are a lot of people who think that we either should move in that direction or that we should move in that direction to abolish the Federal Reserve. We did have a long period in American history from 1783, largely with some exceptions, through 1913, when we did not have a functioning Federal Reserve system, and we allowed banks in different regions to make their own money. And just to be fair and honest here, we had regular severe financial and banking panics, much more severe than the one we had in 2007 and 2008.
However, those panics were regional and they weren't national or international.
There were only a few that were national. There were a few that were national here, but very few that we have measured recorded history of in the U.S. were particularly international. But we had a regular seasonal crisis in which when farmers sold their products in October, it's the reason that people associate September and October with bad months for the financial markets.
Uh-huh.
The banks suddenly had inadequate supplies of money because they paid out all the money to the farmers who took out their money when they got their crops. And we had regular bank failures and regular panics. I mean, they tended to be less severe and less large than the ones we associate with the 1930s and to some extent the ongoing crises since 2007, 2008. But we did have regular instability and crises. And there is evidence that no one who's ever emerged as a major economic power in the history of the modern world has ever done so without a cogent, competent central banking system. So you have to go on mostly theoretical arguments from 100 to 200 years ago to make the argument for the possibility of life without a functioning central bank.
But can't that money be debt-free?
What would you think,
you can
for
have
example?
Lower debt loads. The enormous debt loads we associate with sort of the present time are historically and internationally anomalous and really come about starting in the late 80s and the 1980s in the United States. They're highly undesirable. They haven't normally been associated with successful or healthy economic activity. Most countries don't have them. We didn't have it through most of our history. The high debt levels, I think, are quite unhealthy, quite unfortunate, and I think life would be significantly better without them.
Max, what would you think of issuing greenbacks like Lincoln did during the Civil War, but this time to fund major infrastructure?
Well, we can do that, but we have a system of municipal, state, and federal bonds for infrastructure, which is a sort of more efficient, more large-scale way of doing similar things.
But these would be, say, debt-free. I'm just issue the money. Just,
like the Federal Reserve, that, that's debt-based money.
Just write checks and don't pay any interest on it and put people to work. Would that have a net benefit?
In essence, we're doing a version of that with deficit spending at the state and federal level. We're just going about it through kind of more modern...
But then we have to borrow the money and pay interest on it.
We have to borrow from the Federal Reserve instead of it being issued by the Treasury.
Well, but the Treasury can issue money, but the Treasury can issue money against present or future tax receipts.
Right, and just
otherwise, it's
just
know,
like
more or less
Lincoln did,
fraud.
and he fought the Civil War on greenbacks, which he told the bankers to stuff it at least in part and just
sure,
printed the money.
Sure, you can rein in the banks, remove the profitability of the instrument, and still do it through more modern bond market structure, which I think might make certain
I see.
Sense.
But it's, since we're in a deflationary environment, it seems it, I why not just spend the money on infrastructure and put people back to work? And
I think that's a perfectly reasonable idea, but that comes down to what we want to spend our government money on. It isn't so much more money versus less money, because not all government spending is equally potent in increasing employment and pushing up the level of economic growth.
And we come back, we swing round back to discussing what is a free market economy, and can you have a free market economy with a government that spends $3.5 trillion, given that those huge expenditures are bound to have an effect on your economy?
Yeah, I mean, there's no way of talking about the economy as though there wasn't a huge role for the government at any time in the foreseeable future. What I think is more prudent to question is, what are the areas that it's more and less desirable to have government involvement in? What's an appropriate size for that government involvement? And what do governments do well that private sectors don't do? For instance, infrastructure, public health, public education, and what do private markets tend to do better than governments? And there's a long list of things that we have a long history of seeing private markets
right.
do a much better job of
right.
than
excuse
government.
Excuse me, Max, I think we have another caller for you. Hello, caller, you're on the air. You're speaking with economist Max Wolf. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Hey, this is Richard Stowe. Max, how you doing?
Hey, Richard, nice to hear from you.
Yeah, definitely. Nice to hear you. Your thoughts. I wanted to ask you about our trade deficit, particularly with China, and what the environmental associated environmental impacts are involved with that trade deficit, and whether you believe reducing reliance on Chinese manufacturing as a generator of our economy, what kind of impacts that would have.
Okay, so first, we do have a large trade deficit, which has largely doubled in the last 15 years. It's become a problem. It's a drag on economic growth, and in many ways, it does reduce the competitiveness and the employment intensity in the U.S. economy, both of which are highly undesirable. Long-distance trade and trade with multiple international points of production, where goods are made in parts by various people and shipped all over the world and then shipped to far-flung third locations for consumption, is incredibly petroleum-intensive and carbon-based fuel-intensive, and it was built on the back of very inexpensive basic fuels for inexpensive transport and coordination, and also on the telecom and tech revolution that allowed people to coordinate and speak and communicate with each other at very low costs over very great distances, so it's a product of those things. The United States does have a very large trade deficit with China. It is a problem. We will see it come front and center at the G20 meetings later this month in South Korea. So, I mean, I think it's on the radar of a lot of different people. And I would make one other point, which I think Richard's interesting question may allude to, which is some of what we've done to have a quote-unquote cleaner economy in the West writ large in the United States is move dirty technologies and dirty production processes to other countries where they're likely to be even dirtier than they would be in the United States or Western Europe because there's less regulation. and people have told themselves that this is a clean economy, and what it's actually done is become a dirtier economy far away in a place with less regulations, which then has a product which is shipped thousands of miles to us, but actually becomes much dirtier. We just don't see it. And the other downside of it, too, is that it's caused us to lose significant amounts of jobs in certain areas that are particularly, quote-unquote, dirty in their production process.
Richard, thanks very much for that call. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Max, we've really enjoyed this conversation.
Yes, thank you very
much. Tremendously illuminating.
My pleasure. Always a nice
and you've really helped us to sort out some very difficult questions. And I hope we can have this conversation again in the future.
I look forward to it. Thanks, and thanks to all the callers.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Max. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Canavero. You've been listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. Thanks very much for joining us. And please join us again this Sunday at 10 p.m. when we'll be discussing important news stories and again taking your calls. You can also share your thoughts with us on our blog, incontextreport.com. And thanks very much to Chris Teske for his invaluable help at the board tonight. And stay tuned for his program, which is coming up next on WPKN.
See ya. I can remember that mention all